I want to begin by saying that I don't think I've ever tackled or attempted to tackle a subject quite as elusive as this one has turned out to be. As Dan can attest, my critical framework, even the films under investigation, seem to change on an almost bi-weekly basis. And I'm grateful to Dan both for his patience and his encouragement, because as shifty as it's all been, it's also been incredibly exciting, a superlative phrase, incidentally, I never thought I'd apply to the subject of tuberculosis. A testament to the mutability of my topic, I only last week discovered that two of Ulmer's TB films, two titles unmentioned in the existing Ulmer scholarship and barely referenced in Ulmer's own simultaneously meticulous and also rather chaotic production notes, which his daughter Ariane Ulmer Sipes so graciously provided me with, were made for Fox Movietone. True to the biweekly mutations of my research, once these films are located, my ideas will no doubt change course once again, but more on mutation later. Before we get into it, I wanted to give a little bit of background about the films themselves and how they came about. From the late 1930s through the early 1940s, the well-known B-movie director Edgar Ulmer, also sometimes called the King of PRC, directed what now appears to be 8 health shorts for the American Tuberculosis Association. The dates attached to these films vary wildly from source to source, though I think I've arrived at something close to a chronology based largely on Ulmer's own press clippings, his contracts and itemized budgets for the films, and the Tuberculosis Association's rather detailed promotional catalog entries. The films include Let My People Live from 1938 or 39, Cloud in the Sky from 39 or 40, They Do Come Back, Goodbye Mr. Germ, and Diagnostic Procedures, all from 1940, and Another to Conquer from 1941. And that mysterious pair of undated Fox Movietone films, Mantu Text, Ulmer's notes have it as text, though I suspect that the title might well have been Test, and Life is Good. Though some sources indicate that these films were being produced as late as 1949, I suspect that the later dates that have been recorded, and in fact the variance in dates more generally, reflect the TBA's own idiosyncratic record-keeping, and perhaps more critically, their desire to make the media that they were providing for classroom use, for church use, etc., seem fresh nearly a decade later, after production, a process which, incidentally, did not preclude their making significant changes to the films themselves, but again, more on that later. The films were made in the midst of what might justifiably be called Ulmer's East Coast melodrama period, his post The Black Cat and pre-PRC years. Noah Eisenberg, who's writing a biography on Ulmer in his recent article in Cinema Journal, refers to this span of years as Ulmer's ethnic intermezzo. An even more poetic phrasing, perhaps, though Eisenberg is also careful not to romanticize what was also one of a string of very difficult periods in Ulmer's career. More than Ulmer's also quite fascinating Yiddish films, however, which have received both some critical attention, Eisenberg's work does much to place them in context, and some popular play. TCM featured a good number of them in a recent retrospective, and they've also been issued on DVD by the National Center for Jewish Film. Ulmer's commercial, industrial, military, and educational work is often glossed in the existing Ulmer literature and is infrequently screened. The place of this work in the Ulmer oeuvre, perhaps in film history, is tenuous to say the least, and the TB films, which are themselves difficult to enumerate, are just a small fraction of this output. The mere mention of an oeuvre, perhaps, exposes a thread in my methodology that Ulmer's fascinatingly diverse career would seem to defy. It is, in some ways, this tension that so intrigues me. I'm aware, for instance, that my interest in Ulmer's TB films is guided by my awareness of an interest in Ulmer. The National Archives, just as an example, holds nearly 100 films produced between 1920 and the 1940s on the subject of tuberculosis. Many of these are also part of the National Tuberculosis Association's campaign, but for now at least, Ulmer's are the films that seem to draw my attention. What I'm saying, I guess, is that from the outset of this project, I was guilty of looking for traces of Ulmer in the work that I was exploring, and this has proven to be a really difficult task. I think it, in many ways, the research itself has defied those intentions. After TCM's screening of Goodbye, Mr. Germ, I set about locating the films mentioned in Peter Bogdanovich's 1970 interviews with Edgar Ulmer. Then there were thought to be only four of these TB films. I thought I already had the pieces of an argument. Ulmer's first feature, the 1933 VD film, Damaged Lives, and the potential of using both TB and VD in the same title was pretty tempting, I have to admit. I went in excited about the fact that Vera in Ulmer's Detour from 1945 is dying of tuberculosis. While holed up in their cheap apartment, Vera starts coughing, and Al says to her, "You've got a mean cough. You ought to do something about it." And Vera snaps back, "I'll be all right." To which Al replies, not skipping a beat, "It's what Camille said." And then arrogantly, under his breath, he says, "Nobody you'd know." Looking unusually concerned, even fragile, Vera asks, "Wasn't that the dame that died of consumption?" I went in looking too, knowing too that conceptually disease had been a fascination of Ulmer's since his literal investigation of it in Damaged Lives, that like Ulmer's legendary interest in fate and predetermination, germs and a generalized notion of contagion seemed to form the very foundation of this director's narrative logic. Again, an exemplary moment from Detour guided me. Early in the film, after his girlfriend Sue has left him to make a go of it in California, Al is glimpsed pounding out his living on the piano at the Break of Dawn Club after a jazzified and interestingly irreverent Brahms redo, a customer request. Said customer flags a waiter, hands him a bill, and the waiter makes his way to Al, who narrates his thoughts on the whole thing, saying, "When this drunk handed me a 10 spot after a request, I couldn't get very excited. What was it, I asked myself? A piece of paper crawling with germs." Some additional research into the screening history of Goodbye, Mr. Germ, however, resulted in some fascinating findings that pushed me in other directions, or pushed and pulled me. Some other prints appeared to exist. TCM showed David Kalatz from All Day Entertainment's personal print, and not just of Goodbye, Mr. Germ. From the film forums, Bruce Goldstein had borrowed the film along with Another to Conquer directly from the New York offices of the American Lung Association. What in the 30s and 40s when the films were being produced was called the National Tuberculosis Association for a 1998 retrospective. BFI had showed both Another to Conquer and Cloud in the Sky in 2004 to mark the filmmaker's 100th birthday. Eastman House screened their print of Let My People Live in 1994 for an audience, I'm told, of 12. And the Austrian Film Museum borrowed the same print in 2003 for their highly attended Ulmer retrospective. Learning that all of the films, except the Fox Movietone films, were in the National Archives was the break I had hoped for, and I focused on trying to screen at Orphans 5, one of the two films that, according to my research, had not been screened for many, many years, namely either Diagnostic Procedures or They Do Come Back. All of the films Ulmer produced were clearly aimed at a segment of the American population at the height of the TB crisis. The segments that get written about, probably because of Ulmer's other work in this area, are the ethnic segments. Cloud in the Sky was for Mexican Americans, and two versions, a Spanish and an English version, are preserved at the National Archives. Another to Conquer was for Native Americans and features the most stunning location shooting of the entire bunch. And here, from the still from Another to Conquer, is a frame that depicts the community's elder, Slow Talker, in a posture that perfectly captures his transition within the film. Looking towards the heavens in the midst of his own rehabilitation, Slow Talker narrates his desire to conquer the disease. More interestingly, however, the film is concerned with conquering Slow Talker and his generation's life-threatening traditionalism. This is a major theme in many of the films, this kind of antiquated faith of the older generation. Let My People Live is aimed at African Americans, was shot at and used drama students from Tuskegee, and the health department prominently featured the film at the 1939 World's Fair. All of the films take great pains to treat the minorities being examined with dignity. Let My People Live, however, goes further than the other films in its depiction of minority members of the medical establishment who speak both from the pulpit early in the film, in the film's opening scene, and later in the film, analyze x-rays and sputum tests in sort of a more traditional kind of physician's mise-en-scene. The other two films, for all of their interest in and respect for other cultures, imagine the intervention, the needful intervention of white doctors. Less discussed are the groups addressed in the other films. Goodbye, Mr. Germ is geared towards very young children and features the brilliant animation of H.L. Roberts. The film features an animated character, T.B., who is communicated with via a fantastic two-way germ radio. Interestingly, T.B. had made his screen debut about 8 years earlier in another T.B. Association film called The Story of My Life by T.B. I think it's likely that the character was familiar to children from the association's printed material as well. Diagnostic procedures is aimed at the medical establishment and moves rather dryly and methodically through the stages of diagnosis and analysis. The film itself is tediously academic, though I remain fascinated at the fact that Ulmer's directorial credit in the film reads Edgar G. Ulmer, PhD. I talked to daughter Ariane about this, and she told me that Ulmer's belief all through his life had been that people should be granted honorary degrees just for walking by the gates of a university. She also kindly warned me in the same conversation about her father's somewhat legendary truth-stretching abilities. Aimed as the film was at medical practitioners, I wonder if the initials aren't also an attempt on the part of the National TB Association to lend to this material a degree of credibility. The film that made the most sense for an orphan's debut, in part because the materials were of such high quality, and in part because, again, it had not been shown, it seemed to be a true orphan, was They Do Come Back. Aimed at young, working age, and I think quite critically white Americans, the film is interesting both for its differences from and its similarity to the other Ulmer-produced TB films. Taking place in every town USA, which actually turns out to be Philadelphia, the film borrows much from Ulmer's Damaged Lives. Romance, here in the form of a kiss, leads to disaster. As the title suggests, however, there is also redemption. Our characters do come back. Now, this is where things get interesting. This is what I thought the film was about. When I visited the National Archives in December, they pulled They Do Come Back from me, and I viewed the film just described, the film, incidentally, which begins with a very clear directorial credit, Edgar G. Ulmer, and ends with an aggressive plea to buy Christmas seals. The film matched almost word for word the script that Ulmer's daughter had sent me, and it corresponded perfectly to the TBA's own publicity materials. I was pretty confident that the film would make a fine candidate for a new print. But the new print that was made, however, quite literally tells a different story. While composed largely of the same parts, the print that was struck is a different film, a different narrator, a different narrative. Even Ulmer's beloved Brahms Fourth Symphony, which opened the program, the same piece Al embellishes, incidentally, in Detour, had been replaced. The archive is still investigating the mix-up. It seems logical, however, that the TBA had recut and re-narrated the film, possibly for a particular market and likely at a later date. Otherwise, their publicity material makes very little sense. What the archive assumed to be a pair of identical prints is anything but, and our ability to apply the name Ulmer to the film, which was difficult to begin with, is now somewhat more difficult. What I've decided to do is show the 35mm print, which is interesting in its own right, and then show some clips afterwards of what I'm calling the earlier version. I don't think I can call it the director's cut. This was, I can assure you, a really difficult decision for me, but it's also one, I think, that helps establish a critical point about the unknowable fate, and I think Ulmer would have loved this, of orphaned material. The earlier version is, like Ulmer's other TB films, thoughtfully sensational. Alois Havrila, the famous radio announcer, narrates and lends to the narrative, a narrative which is strangely understated in this later version, a brisk urgency. The film is also, in spite of its focus on white characters, somewhat more consistent within the collective of six Ulmer-produced TB films. What's dropped from the earlier version, in fact, matters deeply. After the screening, I'll say a few words about the differences and about a critical thematic thread that runs through Ulmer's TB films. Where Marchand Skip explored the curious religion disguised as science from the Moody films, Ulmer's TB films are up to something different. Religion, in fact, becomes a mechanism by which to smuggle science and medicine in. Recalling his daughter's warning, of course, Ulmer's explanatory notes remind us that he had a hand in their writing. This is a quote from his notes. The films for the National Tuberculosis Association and the U.S. Health Department were documentaries of varying lengths promoting the fight against TB on a national basis. These films were prepared, written, etc., in my spare time as a service, and when available, I was hired to produce and direct them between my feature assignments and during layoff periods while I was under contract at Springer. Les Waffen at the National Archives has generously facilitated the creation of this new print. The print we'll be looking at is a theatrical print made from a negative struck from an original nitrate print. This film, along with 8 other titles, totaling 34 reels, was received at NARA on May 23, 1945, so not long after their production, based on an offer letter of January 4, 1945, from Martha E. Pusch for the Committee on Archives for the National Tuberculosis Association. So while its authorship has been rendered mysterious, here is a film at least composed largely of Edgar G. Ulmer's They Do Come Back, and it's also called They Do Come Back.
Life in a big American city seems strange and chaotic. But behind the walls of steel and concrete, there are many organizations planning and guiding the forces that affect the health and happiness of the city's people. Let us stop to hear the story of one such group of trained men and women. They help fight a disease that threatens the very lives of those who live and work in this city and in every other city and village throughout the world. Begins in a factory, typical of the industrial plants that produce the materials of modern living. It is the story of Roy Adams, just one of millions of young American workers whose jobs make grueling demands on their health and strength. Another factory far across the town works Julie Clark, Roy's fiancée, who is typical of a generation of American women who are proud of being able to earn their own living. sanatorium for thorough examination. Doctors know that blood from the mouth may mean tuberculosis. Skilled hands, trained eyes and ears inquire into the cause of the bleeding and make notes of what they find. They use the magic eye of the X-ray that can see through flesh and muscle. Only a shadow picture is produced, but the doctor can tell the meaning of those shadows as you can tell the meaning of clouds. The sputum sample is spread on a glass slide and examined under the microscope, which enlarges it 1,000 times. The tuberculosis joke. To the medical staff, all the facts put together signify tuberculosis of the left lung far advanced. But if Roy obeys the rules, his chances are good. The treatment is to begin with absolute bed rest for a month. Tuberculosis radically changes Roy's life. It puts a sudden stop to work and play and plans for the future. Rest for Roy. But not for the city health guardians. They know that each case of tuberculosis comes from another. They must find Roy's associates and warn them, help them. Case finders inquire, from whom did Roy get it? To whom has he given it? They ask his employer about his workmate. Is there someone who gave him the disease? Someone to whom Roy has given it? This is how germs get from one body to another. A nurse is assigned to find out about Roy's home, his work, his close associates. The nurse asks for clues. Roy's friends cooperate. Here is a clue easy to follow. Julie, where does she live? The nurse then questions Julie. That was lip contact, the surest way for tuberculosis germs to enter the body. Julie need not be frightened, but she must see a doctor. Besides the routine examination of the chest, the doctor includes a simple skin test which tells whether tuberculosis germs have found a foothold in the body. If negative, it means no tuberculosis. If positive, it means further examination is necessary. Raised and red. The test is positive. Now Julie is x-rayed. Here are the shadows expertly interpreted by her doctor. They say early tuberculosis. This is the time to take steps. Sooner the treatment, the more certain the cure. Bed rest now for Julie. A very dull life this, but reading helps. Good reading helps Julie, as it has so many others, to readjust her life. A friendly place, this sanatorium. The medical chief talks to all patients. By such means, patients are educated in a new way of life. Listen in with Julie and all the patients to what the doctor says. Our sanatorium is but one of the many base hospitals of the Great Warfare. Here we train doctors, nurses, technical workers to carry on the battle. The sanatorium cares for sick people and returns them to a useful life. Here the resources of medical science are put into practice. Treatment of the patient means the defeat of tuberculosis. by the nationwide tuberculosis association, supported by the public, to broadcast the vital message, tuberculosis can be cured. Someday Julie will help this association to help others, but first she must get better, and that means rest. After weeks of bed rest, what about Roy? The x-ray shadows tell Roy's doctor the lung isn't healing rapidly enough. The lung needs absolute rest. Roy needs special treatment. Roy is prepared for a simple operation called pneumothorax. A local anesthetic first to prevent pain. Then, very gently, air is allowed to enter between the rigid chest wall and the soft lung tissue. By means of this operation, the diseased lung is compressed, allowed to rest. Meanwhile, Roy's doctor called a staff meeting to study Roy as a person. The librarian reports on what Roy enjoys reading. The occupational therapist reports that he likes mechanical drawing. And the nurse, Roy's fiance, is no secret to his nurse. From the state employment agent, the doctor learns Roy's former job is too strenuous. He must give this up, too. The whole trained staff works to understand Roy and his problems. Time brings improvement. This earns new privileges for Roy. The employment agent knows about jobs and training for jobs. Roy's doctor calls on this knowledge to help plan a new life for Roy. First, a series of tests to find Roy's talent. How fast can Roy do clerical work? Does he have mechanical aptitude? Quickly does he see pattern, size, design. Has he a knack for handling small tools? The tests answer these questions and tell Roy a lot about himself. Now the doctor adds his knowledge of Roy's physical capacity to what the agent knows of jobs and training. Together they work out a plan with and for Roy. Retraining plan in a growing industry, aircraft. Roy continues to improve. He is well enough to go up. What a privilege it is, after months in bed, just to amble out of doors. However, leisure does not mean idleness. Roy learns photography. And how to develop pictures. A new hobby suitable to his condition. And then there's Julie. Julie too has been studied by the staff. Homemaking is a big job. Julie will need her energy to keep well. running job, even in housekeeping, is that tiring. So Jillie is taught how to avoid taxing her strength in housekeeping. It's goodbye at last to hospital routine. But like others before him, Roy takes with him health and valuable knowledge. Re-education for Roy now goes ahead full speed. He learns a new trade. To protect him and his workmates, Roy's health is checked, and his training is watched by the agent. It soon leads to a job. Like thousands of others, Roy and Julie have won the fight against tuberculosis, but not alone. They have been saved by the public and private organizations that are at work in every democratic community for the health and happiness of all.
This research makes me worry every time I hear anybody cough. Spreading the word in an effort to stop the spread of disease was obviously, I suppose, the Tuberculosis Association's primary task, and Ulmer's films played a decisive role in this multifaceted, multimedia defensive strategy. However, the strategy itself is not altogether consistent. Like Ulmer's other films, They Do Come Back traces the effects of the disease on a central young couple. The couple is still present in this version, but strangely more distant, replaced, I think, by a more centrally figured and rather heroic medical establishment. Critically, however, our young couple in both versions of They Do Come Back seem to accept the science that will be their salvation without question. Their absorption into the sanatorium is as natural as their eventual and titular absorption back into society, a process that involves a change of jobs for Roy and the cheerful abandonment of a careerist future for Julie and marriage. The films addressing the disease and its effects on minority communities are somewhat differently pitched. In these films, the disease is first imagined as striking key figures within the community's older generation. The young are then left to make a decision, follow along the traditional and typically faith-based path of their elders, or, as another To Conquer has it, heed the wisdom of the white doctor's ways. Again, the intentions here are rather indisputable. TB was especially rampant within minority communities. A phenomenon, Let My People Live, takes great pains to underline as the film's progressive minister, Dr. Gordon, played by Rex Ingram, explains the diminished defenses of the impoverished home. Let My People Live also concerns a young couple, George and Mary, both from families affected by the disease. Mary, afraid that she's stricken, seeks the advice of her minister, who demands that she see a real doctor. From the opening, images of a scientist speaking before an enraptured crowd from the pulpit through the end of the film, Let My People Live is intent upon using organized religion to promote science and medicine, and is equally committed to questioning the efficacy of what is viewed as to be a dangerously immobile faithfulness. The real conflict between science and its alternatives occurs on the street in Let My People Live. On the way to the doctor, Mary runs into her friend, Minnie, who looks her up and down and says, and I'm reading directly from the script here, I knowed it. You got's the same thing your mama had, ain't you? The interaction takes place just at the doctor's door. Minnie advises that she take some of her grandma's considerably less expensive tea. After all, no doctor's going to cure her. The erroneous hoodooism of the older generation is foregrounded here, its belief in the heredity of the disease systematically taken apart, and their faithful subscription to folk traditions cautiously dismantled, as Mary thinks twice and enters the doctor's office as her minister had suggested. Another to Conquer is similarly themed. Nima and Don, as the promotional materials for the film would have it, are made orphans by the disease and are left on the reservation, following the wisdom of their science-fearing grandfather and the community's respected leader, Slow Talker. Robert, their neighbor, has gone away to school, forsaking tradition, as his detractors say, and has learned the scientific ways of the white man, has learned, in fact, that he has TB, and through rest and treatment is cured. Again, the issue is not played cheaply. The doctors are aware of and interested in native customs and use these as points of comparison throughout the film. And this is, in fact, the crux of Ulmer's TB films. Science must, like the germ itself, take root within the supposedly pre-existent belief structures of the given minority group and use those structures to multiply outward. In Another to Conquer, which obliquely references the many struggles of the Native American, it's Don's death and the threat of Nima's that finally makes Slow Talker bend, only to learn that he has been the carrier of the disease all along. In the final shot, that still that I showed captures him regarding the heavens and committing in voiceover to be a warrior for the cause. Cloud in the Sky features as its central critical pairing between what the promotional materials calls a wise padre and a white doctor. An early conversation finds the men agreeing that God wants us to use science. Once again, however, only corpses convince the older generation of medicine's usefulness. The padre convinces the Lopez family, now motherless, to see a doctor to address the symptoms their daughter Consuelo now manifests. They go, and Senior Lopez learns so much that he becomes, as the TBA's description has it, a missionary of tuberculosis prevention among his friends. All of this missionary science, however, seems to be lacking, and they do come back, or at least in the version we just viewed. In the alternate version of the film, however, a more consistent preamble seems at once again to establish some relationship to the older generation and to, however subtly and expressively, point to the accumulation of corpses. It also more clearly establishes the film's similar missionary efforts. In the films featuring white characters, technology and not religion is the imagined missionary vehicle. In Goodbye, Mr. Germ, the children delight in their obviously hallucinating father's fanciful scientific vision, a vision that involves germ radios. Radio, along with other media, figure more prominently in the earlier version of They Do Come Back. The film is narrated by Havrilla, and that, I think, is certainly a key. He was a very well-known radio personality, but the radio also functions sermonically in the film. Julie and Roy, in other words, enter the sanatorium without question, perhaps because of the omnipresence of their particular technologically mediated and secularized faith. I'll show a short clip from the beginning of Ulmer's version of the film just to give a sense of Havrilla's quite different narrational techniques and the culpability of the less engaged. Here we wonder if it's because they don't listen to radio, older generation. This will be followed rather abruptly, because I'm a bad editor on tape, apparently, by a clip reminding us of the TBA's own powerfully iconic imagery in a map that is overtaken literally as the media reaches from east to west with its symbol. So if we can cue the video.
Every town, the town in which you and I live, in the north, south, east, or west. Our homes, our work, our recreations make every town what it is. Every town is on the move, swinging in the rhythm of these United States. Yet in every town, happiness and security are challenged daily by an enemy. This enemy strikes oftenest at youth. His name is tuberculosis. Here is the germ that causes this disease. All of us in every town bear the burden of tuberculosis, but it weighs heaviest on those whose loved ones it attacks and often kills. Tuberculosis blasts the hope of parents, parents who have made uncounted sacrifices for their children. Tuberculosis, maker of orphans, are put into practice in the treatment of the patient and the defeat of tuberculosis. Outside our sanatorium are other forces, health departments, health workers, educators who plan the strategy. The Tuberculosis Association brings the story of tuberculosis to the public by printed matter, on the picture screen, over the air. Throughout the country, tuberculosis associations, backed up by the National Tuberculosis Association, arm every town to make war on the enemy. For the physician, technical publications. For the public, clearly written information. All this made possible by the sale of Christmas seals. Julie listens and learns. Someday she will become one of the soldiers fighting tuberculosis. But first comes the business of getting better, and that means rest.
Okay. Now, the 35 millimeter print that we viewed today is a full 2 minutes shorter than Omer's, and the missing elements are principally those that would make Julie and Roy's plight less different from Omer's raced TB films, namely the material regarding the parents, the somewhat altered missionary response to the disease, and Roy and Julie's heightened devil-may-care approach to their budding romance in Omer's version. The later version presents an almost blameless vision of disease, a vision more in keeping, I think, with what many scholars take to be Omer's view on fate coming out of nowhere to trip us up. But Omer's vision of fate has never been so blameless, and to some degree, I think, his TB films correct that misconception. We, however, are left to wonder just exactly what the TBA saw themselves to be correcting. Thank you.